From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Paul Schrader talks about directing his new movie, Autofocus. It's based on the true story of the secret life of Bob Crane. Crane was the star of the 60s sitcom Hogan's Heroes. He used his celebrity to attract women, and without them knowing, he often videotaped their sexual encounters. Crane was murdered, but the case was never solved. Paul Schrader also directed the films Affliction, Blue Collar, and Hardcore. He wrote the screenplays for Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, and The Last Temptation of Christ. Also, we remember best-selling historian Stephen Ambrose. He died yesterday at the age of 66. He had lung cancer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Indonesia's defense minister has blamed al-Qaeda and its extremist allies for the bomb attack that killed more than 180 people at a nightclub on the island of Bali. The BBC's Richard Galpin reports.
This is the first time anyone from the Indonesian government has publicly stated who they believe was responsible for the worst terrorist attack in the country's history. And it was backed up by the Australian Foreign Minister Alexander Downer on his arrival in Bali. He said he'd also been told of the al-Qaeda link by Indonesian officials. But speaking earlier in the day, other senior members of the Indonesian government were much more cautious, saying they did not want to preempt the police investigation now underway. Forensic experts have continued to sift through the rubble in the area where the bomb exploded with such devastating effect, and they're being joined by investigators from Australia, the United States, and Britain.
The BBC's Richard Galpin in Bali. Palestinian security sources say that Israeli soldiers killed two Palestinian militants today near the West Bank town of Jenin. The men were reportedly shot in their car, shortly after Palestinians blew up a bomb near an Israeli army patrol. The Israeli army said the bomb caused no injuries to its soldiers. The militant group Islamic Jihad announced the deaths in Jenin and said it would avenge them. The violence comes as Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon prepares for a visit with President Bush. Sharon called on Palestinians today to overthrow their leadership, headed by Palestinian Authority President Yasser Arafat. The police chief overseeing the investigation into the Washington area sniper attack says authorities are making good progress. He spoke even as many residents feared more of the shootings that have killed 8 people and wounded 2 in the past 2 weeks. The last shooting was Friday. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
Montgomery County Police Chief Charles Moose admits he may sound overly optimistic since police have not made public any strong leads, but he's repeatedly told reporters he does not want to compromise the investigation. There have been witnesses at several attacks, but Moose defended the decision not to release a sketch of the suspected sniper.
We want to keep an open mind. We'd like for people to look at the big picture. If we put that out, it's almost as if somehow now the police have said that the individual is this age, and anyone outside that you're thinking about didn't stop thinking about them.
Police have issued a composite of a white box truck seen speeding off after several shootings, and Moose encouraged the public to call or write with any tips. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 27 points to close at 7,877 in active trading. The NASDAQ gained 10 points. It closed at 1,220. The S&P 500 gained 6. This is NPR News. Astronauts aboard the space shuttle Atlantis have completed their third and final spacewalk on the International Space Station. Two astronauts installed a girder that will eventually support 2 science modules and more solar energy panels. The shuttle is due to return to Earth on Friday. The Wall Street Journal reports the world's largest airplane manufacturer is cutting production through 2004. Lisa Labas reports from Chicago Public Radio.
Chicago-based Boeing had originally planned to slow jet production through next year, but the domestic airline industry isn't showing any sign that it's recovering financially, and Boeing is apparently extending that slowdown for an additional year. Boeing hasn't said exactly how many planes it expects to make in 2004, but senior executives hint that at best, deliveries of new planes will remain flat with the level of 2003. Boeing expects to deliver about 380 planes this year. That's down 28% from 2001. Officials say they expect to deliver 300 planes next year, but say that number could drop, especially if airlines file for bankruptcy protection. Today's report comes just before Boeing releases its third-quarter earnings on Wednesday morning. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Labus in Chicago.
One of the nation's biggest poultry producers has ordered the largest meat recall in U.S. history because of fears of contamination by Listeria bacteria. Pilgrim's Pride Company is recalling 27 million pounds of turkey and chicken products. The recall was triggered by a U.S. Department of Agriculture investigation into a Listeria outbreak that's blamed for at least 23 deaths. Pilgrim's Pride and the USDA said the recall is not directly related to any illnesses. Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Buffalo Niagara Enterprise, representing Buffalo Niagara, New York. High-tech infrastructure, historic architecture, and snow-white winters. BuffaloNiagara.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Paul Schrader has a new movie called Autofocus. Schrader also wrote the screenplays for the films Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, and The Last Temptation of Christ, and directed the films Affliction, American Gigolo, and Hardcore. His new film, Autofocus, had its world premiere last month at the Telluride Film Festival, where Schrader was the subject of a special tribute. Autofocus is about sexual obsession and how it can be fed by the adulation that comes with celebrity. It's based on the true story of a minor celebrity, Bob Crane. He starred in Hogan's Heroes, the 60s sitcom set in the unlikely place of a World War II prisoner of war camp run by the Germans. Here's a scene from the actual sitcom featuring the characters of Sergeant Schultz, Colonel Klink, and the American POW Hogan, played by Bob Crane.
Up, 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 up! Everybody arouse, 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 arouse! You're going to be counted, everybody, up!
Gentlemen, gentlemen, sorry to disturb your beauty sleep. This won't take very long. Count them, Schultz.
Yeah, what are you going on? Hey, hey, hey! It's all the excitement.
Ah! Colonel Hogan! Good evening!
Don't you Germans ever knock?
I wanted to keep it a surprise.
It's bad taste waking people up in the middle of the war.
Just a minute, Hogan. The count is not over yet.
All right, get on with it.
What's your rush? You're not going anywhere.
As a matter of fact, I have a date in town.
Oh, really? Who's the lucky girl?
It's not a girl, it's an Eskimo.
Good old Yankee sense of humor.
Right. We're going to laugh all the way to Berlin.
The viewers of Hogan's Heroes didn't know that actor Bob Crane was obsessed with sex. He used his fame to attract women and would often record his adventures with them on early state-of-the-art home video. After Hogan's Heroes ended in 1971, Crane had trouble finding work. He toured the country doing dinner theater. In this scene from Autofocus, Crane is washed up and still trying to impress women with whatever celebrity remains from his Hogan's Heroes days. Sitting at a hotel bar with his eye on a woman, he asks the bartender to switch the TV to the channel showing a Hogan's Heroes rerun. Crane is played by Greg Kinnear.
I'm sorry to bother you. It's just that I was sitting over there and I noticed the TV and I... Well, is that you on the TV? Is that...
Oh, my gosh. That is embarrassing. I didn't even know it was on. I'm Bob Crane.
I know. I thought so.
Yeah.
Bob Crane. Gosh, it's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
Oh, Susan.
Susan, all right.
I loved your TV show.
Well, appreciate that. I'm just in town here to do a little bit of theater.
I just wanted to say hi.
Sure. Can I get you something? Another drink? An autograph?
Well,
a nude swim?
Bob.
You know, I'm a real photo nut. And how long are you girls in town?
Bob Crane was beaten to death in his hotel room in 1978. His secret life was uncovered during his murder trial. I spoke with Paul Schrader about directing his new film, Autofocus. What are the parts of Bob Crane's story that most interested you?
There were a number of things that attracted me to the story and to the life of Bob Crane. But at the base of it, it had the power of fiction. And I think that's the starting point for any film biography. If you wouldn't tell this story, if it wasn't about a real person, then you should have second thoughts about telling it at all. And so what I found in Crane's life was a kind of emblematic or totemic American male life, 1965, 1980. And a man who was going through the flip side of female liberation. And I realized he was a character, like many other characters that attracted me, which is essentially a person who wants to do one thing or wants to think he is one thing and behaves in the opposite way. And, you know, this is the heart and soul of psychoanalysis. You know, if we want to be happy, why do we do things that make us unhappy? And so when you run into a character who lives that dilemma large, who comes at you like, you know, two bright headlights of contradiction, that's quite attractive.
Now, you said you see the Bob Crane story as being the flip side of women's liberation. And it seems to me like the women's liberation movement and the whole, like, sexual revolution of the 60s and early 70s was about, you know, undoing certain repressions, feeling more free, testing certain limits. But with the Bob Crane story, I mean, it's a compulsion. It's something he has no control over. And he may see it as fitting into, like, the whole, like, sexual revolution and cultural revolution of the 60s. But what he's got is a serious compulsion. It's a problem that's out of control.
Yeah, but as he says, I'm normal. Sex is normal.
Well, that's what he thinks.
Yeah, you know, it's good for you.
Right.
Which is sort of the delightful conundrum. And since he was living in that climate of liberated feelings all across the board, whether it be, you know, political or sexual or drug or civil rights, he just felt that he was, you know, in the groove. But what was interesting in some ways is that he was that kind of 60s hep cat, that kind of rack pat sort of jazz mentality, who had to put on, you know, beads and bell bottoms to keep scoring chicks, and in the end remained every inch the sexist he ever was.
Right. How do you see the character of Bob Crane connecting with other characters you've made movies about? Like Travis in Taxi Driver, or the character in American Gigolo, or the father in Hardcore.
Well, I mean, I think that, like, beginning with Travis, the first script I wrote, or going to Affliction, a more recent movie, you have a person who is, again, acting at cross purposes. And so, you know, Bob Crane is saying, you know, I'm a one-woman man, I'm a family man, and all the while this tail is growing out his backside. Usually, when I make these kind of characters, at some point, at the end, they have a brief moment where they get it, you know, because essentially they're kind of clueless and they're out of sync. And all of a sudden, they get it for a moment. Wade Whitehouse in Affliction gets the fact that he has to kill his father. But Bob Crane never gets it. He's as clueless on the day he dies as he was on the day we meet him.
Yes, the Bob Crane character in your movie is delusional. He's clueless. He thinks he's kind of happily indulging in sex, not realizing the depth that he's sinking to. But he also narrates the movie. So what are some of the tricky issues you have to deal with when the main character is narrating their own story, but they're kind of totally delusional and clueless about what's really happening to their life?
Well, you've just touched on something that I really love doing, which is the unreliable narrator. Because narration works sort of like intravenous feeding. You're getting nourishment, but you don't taste it. So it seeps into your consciousness. And so, therefore, you assume that your narrator is reliable. Well, when he's unreliable, it creates a nice little frisson between what you're seeing and what you're hearing. And again, it goes back to Taxi Driver, you know, my first script, where you had an unreliable narrator. He was telling you how the world worked, and you were seeing that world, and it wasn't working the way he was telling you it worked. Again, the same here with Mr. Crane. So the narration does a number of things. It helps you expositionally because you're covering 15 years. It also allows you to hear how this man thinks. But it also creates an odd dislocation between what you're hearing and what you're seeing.
In your movie, the character of Bob Crane has a friend named John Carpenter, who's based on a real character in Crane's life. And he's a high-end video salesman and repairman who's in on all the new technology of the 60s. So you have, you know, he's selling these like emerging video tape recorders that you can use at home and video cameras, and this is kind of revolutionary for home recording equipment, and the celebrities, the rich people, are the first people who can afford to buy it. So Crane's really thrilled to get into this. Tell us a little bit about the John Carpenter character and his role in the story.
Carpenter worked for a company called Sonicom at that time, and they were issuing the first VTRs, which was videotape recorder, before there were VCRs. And he kind of freelanced, and he tried to place this equipment in the hands of celebrities, as they often do when they have a new product. And he had sold one to Richard Dawson, who was a gadget freak, and then Dawson was on the same show, Hogan's, as Bob Crane, and he met Bob Crane. Well, they became pals, and Bob's eldest son, you know, told me that he thought John Carpenter was his father's only friend. And they hunted chicks together, and they hunted chicks for a dozen years. And they videotaped and cataloged their exploits. And, you know, they became a kind of symbiotic team. When Crane was murdered, it was the police theory that Carpenter killed him because Crane was trying to break off the relationship. They subsequently took John to trial, and he was acquitted. It was a good fit for them. It was motive, means, and opportunity. Unfortunately, they just didn't have the evidence, and the jury was out about 20 minutes, and he was acquitted.
In a way, I mean, like, celebrity enables people to indulge their appetites in the extreme, as it did for Bob Crane. I'm wondering if that's something you've seen happen a lot in Hollywood. You know, where people indulge appetites that aren't necessarily healthy, at least not at that level.
Well, it's not just Hollywood. It's, you know, it's every community has its star, too.
True, right.
And, you know, most of us, or most of them, you know, who are successful have pretty strong governors, you know, ways they know that how they have to control their behavior if they are going to maintain this fame and financial security that they have struggled so hard to achieve. And the irony in Crane's case, you know, he struggles 20-some years to come from nowhere to become a TV star and a hit disc jockey. And then he reaches a point where his behavior is undermining that, and he can't stop.
Paul Schrader, have you thought a lot about how a sexual drive can get so out of control?
Well, I don't know whether it's sex per se or it's just addictive behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever you have addictive behavior, there's a big displacement going on. Something else is being replaced. You know, it's like the drug addict that says, I used to have a lot of problems, but now I've only got one.
Right.
And also part of his sexual addiction was a kind of cataloging. When he was a family man with his young children, he used to catalog all the games they played. When he became the home porn freak, he cataloged all the women. There was something going on there that was beyond simple, you know, sexual release. And it was a kind of obsessive-compulsive, addictive force that was blotting out or replacing some other insecurity. And that is when, sex becomes problematic, is when it becomes counterproductive to your life. I don't think of someone like Hugh Hefner as being a sex addict, because I think that it's an absolutely functional way for him to live. Crane, it didn't work that way, and he was really of that same generation.
My guest is Paul Schrader. He directed the new film Autofocus. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Paul Schrader. He directed the new movie Autofocus. Another interesting thing about Bob Crane is that here he is, a celebrity indulging this sexual, overindulging the sexual appetite, but he's a kind of small-time celebrity. He's kind of like a one-hit wonder. And, you know, at a certain point in his life, he has to go to, like, hotel bars to find women who will recognize him. So it's another really interesting angle of it, that it's not this big celebrity he has. It's kind of small time.
Well, he ended up on the dinner theater circuit, which it was quite lucrative, and it brought him into, you know, all the bedroom communities of America. And
their bedrooms.
Yeah. And he had, you know, a regular routine. You know, they would do the show, and then he would come out afterward and speak to the audience and sort of work them up and tell them where he was going to be. And he had it down.
And in terms of, like, small-time celebrity, John Carpenter, the video salesman, is always bragging about how he sold video equipment to Tommy Smothers, Dick Rowan, and Elvis. And I love hearing their names all mentioned in the same sentence, like Dick Rowan and Elvis on the same level.
Actually, he also sold it to Jay Silverheels, who played Tonto, and there's a whole kind of Lone Ranger and Tonto motif in the film because Carpenter was half Indian, and of course Bob Crane was the masked man.
Right, right. As you explained, because John Carpenter is this video whiz, he hooks up this videotaping system where he and Bob Crane can secretly tape their sexual adventures with the women they bring over. And then they can get aroused again by watching back the tapes. And they often watch the tapes together, and they get aroused together, and they masturbate while watching these tapes. You have a scene in which that happens. That's a really interesting scene. And I'd like you to talk about shooting that scene, directing that scene, and what kind of tone you were aiming for in that scene. Because you have to strike the right tone.
Yeah, I like that scene. I think it's an absolute hoot. While we were shooting it, I had to sort of bite my tongue to keep from laughing. You know, they're sitting there watching the videos and complaining about women, you know. And Crane says, "What is it about women, Carp? You know, they get you and they change their minds." And all the while, you know, they're jerking off and can't quite figure out why women don't understand them. And I just thought this was just delicious in the extreme. And I ended up the scene, fell back and did a kind of tableau, which I sort of like to think of as my Norman Rockwell. You know, the all-American scene, only in this case it's these two home porn pioneers complaining about women and watching their videos.
Instead of drinking beer and watching the football game and complaining about women. Right. So what was it like directing that scene? What did you tell Willem Dafoe and Greg Kinnear before shooting?
Well, as in everything in this particular film, you want to keep underplaying it always, because it's the accretion of underplaying that finally, you know, gets under your skin and feels really creepy. And so that you're always understating it. So I think Greg at one point wanted to separate the women talk and the masturbation. And I said, you know, if you do that, then you lose the underplaying. The truly sort of funny, odd thing about it is that, you know, both these activities can happen at the same time and they don't see the connection.
No, that's how clueless they really are. The look of the earlier scenes in the movie, in which Bob Crane is still a family man and he hosts a very popular morning radio show in Los Angeles and then starts on Hogan's Heroes, which becomes very successful, the look of those earlier scenes is much different than the look of the later scenes as he descends deeper and deeper into this sexual obsession. Can you talk a little bit about the difference in shooting the earlier scenes and the later scenes?
Well, we came up with an idea called the accretion of clutter, which is that his life just gets messier and messier. And it originally began as an idea for set design. And then we applied it right across the board, color scheme, film stock, camera style, hair, makeup, wardrobe, music, camera technique. And so that by the end of the film, you know, you become aware that you are watching a different movie than you were watching an hour ago. And therefore, there's a kind of incremental shift in all the elements of the film, trying to obscure the exact point where it shifts into another sensibility, you know, much like an addiction itself. You know, an addict can't really tell you the moment it all changed.
And what's different about the camera technique?
Well, it starts out very fluid. You know, dollies and locked off and dollies, and then it moves to steady cam, and then it moves to a kind of handheld pretending to be steady, and then it moves to a handheld not pretending to be steady, and then it moves into hardcore shaky cam where you're going out of focus and everything.
And what about the visual clutter you're talking about, you know, the theory of clutter? What's how does the visual clutter change as the movie evolves?
Well, that first just came out of the idea of cords, of TV and electronic cords, and everybody who's had video in the house knows what a mess that technology makes of your house. And so just using that idea and taking it forward so that the neat, well-ordered house of 1965 becomes the video clutter of 1978.
Paul Schrader directed the new movie Autofocus. Here's another scene. Bob Crane and John Carpenter, his sidekick in his sexual adventures, are sitting at a bar. Carpenter is played by Willem Dafoe.
She's a fox. Look at the caboose on her. Day without sex is a day wasted. This place is dead. We still got time to hit the strip joint.
And we need to talk.
I don't like the sound of that. We gotta talk. That's what a chick says when she's gonna lower the boom.
Thinking about getting out.
Of what?
Whole scene.
What scene?
The dinner theater. All the rest.
Excuse me. I'm confused.
The road, the hustling, the broads, the whole thing.
You mean me? I'm part of the whole thing?
Well, without the dinner theater, we'd see each other less. I want to restart my career.
You're kidding, right?
We'll talk more with director Paul Schrader in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Aveda, maker of earth-sensitive hair, body, and lifestyle products, and proud supporter of NPR's environmental coverage. Information at aveda.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with director Paul Schrader about his new movie, Autofocus. And we remember historian Stephen Ambrose. He died yesterday at the age of 66. He was the author of many bestsellers, including D-Day and Band of Brothers. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Paul Schrader. He wrote the screenplays for Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, and The Last Temptation of Christ, and directed the films American Gigolo, Hardcore, and Affliction. His new movie, Autofocus, is based on the secret life of actor Bob Crane, the star of the 60s sitcom Hogan's Heroes. Crane had a sexual obsession and used his celebrity to attract women. Crane is played in the movie by Greg Kinnear. Now, I have to say, Greg Kinnear is very good in the role of Bob Crane. And he's somebody who started off doing, you know, talk soup on the E! Channel, being a kind of smug comic, making fun of television shows. And he's evolved into a really interesting actor. Did you have any doubts at first about his ability to pull this off?
No. When I first got involved with this film, someone mentioned his name to me. And I thought about 5 seconds, and I said, that is a great idea.
Why?
Because he has all the equipment that Bob Crane had when he walks in the door. He has that glib sensibility, has that smirking, funny, ironic tone. He knows light comedy. These are not easy things to teach an actor. So I had the actor had these, and I had been watching his performances, and I'd seen him grow better, and I felt quite sure that I could take him out in the deep end of the pool. And he would be all right. And I'm comfortable out in the deep end. I'm comfortable out there with an actor in the deep end. And he's comfortable in the shallow end. So it seemed like the best of both worlds, and it actually worked out that way.
In directing the film Autofocus, it's a film about sexuality that's gone out of control. So you have to depict, as realistically as you can, the sex lives of these main characters. On the other hand, you have to be able to screen it in multiplexes. So what was your approach to figuring out what to show and what not to show?
Well, it's about the birth of home porn, so you got to let the audience know that's what you're doing. The ratings board is rather restrictive at the moment, and I thought I was working within the R, and I wasn't, because I was sort of basing my thing, my take on it, on HBO and on 6 Feet Under and The Sopranos, and that's sort of the kind of stuff I was shooting. Well, it turns out you couldn't show 6 Feet Under in a multiplex. It wouldn't be rated R. So I had a number of scenes that I had to deal with in that way, and I chose to obscure or pixelate the offending areas, which is, you know, an unfortunate compromise. And when it goes to Europe, the simulated sex will be as it was shot. But when you see it in the multiplex, it will be pixelated. And I left it pixelated so that the viewer would know that, yes, Bob was shooting hardcore at this time. It wasn't cheesecake. And no, we can't show it to you now.
Do you wish that you could?
Well, I mean, it is simulated, and it's not that different than, it was pretty much the same kind of stuff they're showing on 6 Feet Under. So I was a little thrown when I realized I couldn't.
Now, there's a scene early on in the movie where Bob Crane meets with a priest. And this is when he's still kind of holding to the fiction of his life. And the priest says, it's not easy to resist temptation. You must remove yourself from the occasion of sin. I thought of two things when the priest says that. One is when he says, it's not easy to resist temptation. I thought of your film, The Last Temptation of Christ, obviously. And then I also thought a little bit about your own life, since you grew up in a fundamentalist family, in a family where even dancing and going to see movies was forbidden. I guess I'm wondering if when you broke away from that, where so much that we would consider ordinary and commonplace was forbidden, if it was ever easy to swing to the other extreme and overindulge in things that had been forbidden.
No, I don't think so for me, because I had a Calvinist background, and that ethic is pretty rigorous, and it's pretty hard to escape. This whole sense that you are put on this earth for a reason, there is a moral certainty. At the end of your life, you will be called into account. Even when you leave that world, and even when you break away from it, those elements still stay with you. You know, you really can't run far away enough to run away from that. So, even though you know, I became so-called liberated and lived in Los Angeles. My primary drive was the work and to do things that I felt would be worthy of my talents.
You said that Pauline Kael convinced you to become a film critic instead of a minister, which is what you mm-hmm. were originally studying to be. What did she say to you that convinced you?
Well, she just validated, you know, something that was probably pretty obvious from talking to me. No, I was in pre-sim, and I had met her through one of those serendipities of life that changes one's life. And I had come to New York for a summer to see movies because movies were forbidden and I wanted to know more about them. And after meeting her, she said, you know, you want to be a film critic and we are going to keep in touch. And we did. She became my mentor and eventually she got me into UCLA Film School and got me a job as a critic.
My guest is Paul Schrader. He directed the new movie Autofocus. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Paul Schrader. He wrote Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, The Last Temptation of Christ. He directed Blue Collar, American Gigolo, The Comfort of Strangers, Affliction. His new film is called Autofocus, and it's based on the true story of the actor Bob Crane, who starred in the TV sitcom Hogan's Heroes in the 60s and early 70s. And it turned out that he was leading a very kind of obsessive, sordid sexual life. Your first produced screenplay was Taxi Driver, and in the book Schrader on Schrader, in which you're interviewed and also some of your early work is reprinted, you said that when you were writing Taxi Driver, you were very enamored of guns, you were very suicidal, you were drinking heavily, and you were obsessed with pornography in the way a lonely person is. Can you talk a little bit about that obsession with pornography and how, if at all, it figures into the new movie Autofocus?
Well, I was wandering, and at that time in Los Angeles, where I was living, you know, the Pussycat Theaters were open all night long, and so it was a kind of loner's paradise. And also, it really is such a strong visual world that it kind of is like a narcotic or alcoholic kind of, you know, blurs and blots out all the other pain in your life. So I think that was really more of the function than any overheated prurience.
Now, I have to say, you said that you didn't go to extremes after leaving after leaving the Calvinist religion, but you must have felt like you were doing something very taboo when you were going to strip clubs.
Well, I don't think anything's taboo.
No, but you came up in a world where that was taboo.
No. You know, once you leave a closed community, like Grand Rapids, Michigan was at that time, you in a way sort of fall off the edge of the table. The people you've left behind aren't interested in who you've become. And when you return home, you know, they don't ask you where you've been. And they don't pay attention, in my case, to your career. And so it's almost like you've walked through a doorway into another world. You're still bringing your old world with you, but a lot of the reference points are simply gone.
I want to just get back to that quote from the book Schrader on Schrader, where you said that, you know, when you're writing Taxi Driver, among other things, you were very enamored of guns and you were suicidal. You owned a gun then. Was the gun for possible suicide or for self-protection?
I think, again, you're talking about it's going to blotting out a certain level of emotional pain. And just the fantasy that you can end your life is a palliative and an anesthetic. So that kind of drifted around in the back of my consciousness for a number of years, for in greater and lesser degrees. And then when I got married, and then I had a daughter, and I remember quite well, it was shortly after she was born, I was lying in bed and I realized all the suicidal fantasies were gone. They were just gone now, and I had suddenly been jolted into a reality where I realized how selfish and silly all these fantasies were, and that I could proceed now without them. And I have, although a friend, I told the story to a friend, and he reminded me, he said, "Don't worry, they come back."
Isn't that reassuring? That's what friends are for. but I imagine you've used some of those fantasies of your past for characters, or at least used them to help you understand marginal characters.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the secret of the creative life is how to feel at ease with your own embarrassment.
You know? So that's interesting.
Yeah, because, you know, we're all in, you know, the dirty laundry business, and we're being paid, you know, to take risks and look silly. You know, some people, like race car drivers, get paid to risk their lives in a more concrete way. We get paid to risk our lives in an emotional way.
Since writing and directing a film is risky business in that respect, do you have to banish the film critic in you when you're working on a movie? You know, because a film critic is very critical, and that kind of criticism can paralyze you while you're in the creative process.
Yeah, absolutely. The analogy I like to draw is that the film critic is like a medical examiner. He gets the cadaver on the table, he opens it up and tries to figure out how it lived or why it died. And the filmmaker is like a pregnant mother, who is just simply trying to nourish this thing and trying to make sure that it is not born, stillborn. So that you have to keep the medical examiner out of the delivery room, because he will get in there and he will kill that baby.
That's a great analogy. I really like that. Did you ever talk about that with Pauline Kael, your good friend and mentor who was a film critic?
No, I don't think so.
You like a lot of great movies that weren't necessarily commercial successes, and you realize as a filmmaker and former critic that a commercial success isn't necessarily the sign of a good movie. How much does commercial success mean to you? Like, if autofocus is not a big box office hit, will that affect your view of the film or not?
Well, Jean-Luc Godard once said, "No great movie is successful for the right reason." And I think that's true. So sometimes these films become successful in fluky ways. I have a pretty good feeling about autofocus. I think that it's going to do really quite well. It wasn't that expensive a film. And so I think it will help me. It's hard to finance films. It gets no easier as you get older, particularly now with the stock market where it is. You know, there aren't many crumbs falling off the table. And there's a lot of scavenger dogs out there going for those crumbs. And so that, obviously, any commercial success gives you, puts you at the head of the pack. On top of which, I'm off to, in 9 weeks, to shoot my first studio film in 20 years, a prequel to The Exorcist. So perhaps if I don't completely screw that up, it might be possible, for me to end my career standing on my own feet rather than groveling for coins.
Well, Paul Schrader, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Paul Schrader directed the new film Autofocus. It opens this weekend in New York and L.A. and opens nationwide in November. Best-selling historian Stephen Ambrose died yesterday at the age of 66. He had lung cancer. He played a major part in renewing interest in the history of World War II. His bestsellers about the war include D-Day and Band of Brothers. His bestseller Undaunted Courage told the story of Lewis and Clark. He was very prolific, with about 35 books to his name. But earlier this year, he was accused of having plagiarized some passages of his books. In August of 2001, Fresh Air guest host Neil Conan spoke with Ambrose about the book he had just published, The Wild Blue, The Men and Boys Who Flew the B-24s Over Germany.
You tell this story mostly through the experiences of one pilot and his crew, and the pilot is George McGovern, or I guess I should say Ambassador McGovern, the former U.S. Senator, the Democratic Party's presidential candidate in 1972. Why did you pick George McGovern?
I had been with McGovern in Austria at Innsbruck in 1988 when he was asked to participate in a television documentary that the Austrians were producing because he had been a bomber pilot. And he was reluctant, but he accepted finally and went to do the interview. And it was a woman who was sitting at the desk, and she said, "Now, Senator McGovern, you're world famous for your opposition to war, and especially to the bombing in Vietnam. Yet you were a bomber pilot in World War II. You destroyed our beautiful cities. You killed our women and children. Don't you regret that?" And George said, "No, I don't regret it at all. I wanted to liberate your country, Austria, and Europe from Hitler. And I wanted to do my part, and so I was a bomber pilot. No, I don't regret it at all." Well, she was very distressed to hear that and disappointed. And McGovern then added, "There is one bomb that I do think about quite a lot, and I regret a lot." And she, "What was that?" She said, "What was that?" Well, he was flying back from a mission over Vienna, back to his base in Italy, and the crew called up, "Skipper, we got a bomb, the last bomb, stuck in the bomb bay door, half in and half out of this airplane."
This is a 500-pound bomb.
500-pound bomb. And George immediately said, "Well, we can't land with the bomb sticking out of the bomb bay. You got to either get that thing out of there, drop it, or we're going to all have to bail out when we get over Italy."
And nobody wanted to bail out.
Nobody wanted to bail out. So a couple of the navigator and the radio man went to work on that bomb, and they finally got it free and dry. Now, by this time, McGovern was down about 10,000 feet above the ground, and it was a clear day, and they could watch the bomb go. It hit a farm and just blew it to smithereens, the house and the barn, big fire and so on. And George looked at his watch. It was high noon, and he said, "Oh, oh." He came from South Dakota. He knows what time farmers eat lunch. And he thought, "Oh, Lordy, this is a peaceful little farm. It's not bothering anybody, and I've just killed some people." And, oh, he just felt terrible. And he thought about that a lot over the years between the war, and this happened in 1945, and 1988 when he's on the Austrian TV. Cut. And then a couple of weeks or months later, whenever, they showed it on the television in Austria. And the station got a call from a farmer who said, "It was my farm. I know exactly when it happened. I know it was a single bomber up there. And I want you to tell Senator McGovern, nobody got killed. We saw that bomb and we got into the air raid shelter. He and his wife and his two daughters. And nobody got killed. So please tell Senator McGovern that." "Okay, we will." And then he said, "But one other thing I want you to tell him. I don't care what other Austrians say today. I hated Hitler. And my thought as I watched my farm go up in smoke was, if this shortens the war by 1 minute, it's worth it." Well, the station called George and gave him that message. And as George says today, it just wiped the slate clean. Well, that story has always stuck with me. And then a couple of years ago, I was having dinner with George, and he said that a reporter had been interviewing him and wanted to do a book on his career in the Second World War. 35 missions he flew. Mm-hmm. Got a Distinguished Flying Cross. And I said, "Great, tell the reporter to start with that story of that bomb stuck in the bomb bay door." And George looked at me and said, "I wish you were writing it." And I said, "Well, George, I would love to do that, but this other guy's already gotten started." George said, "I'll talk to him." And he did, and I got the assignment, and so I did this book.
We're listening to Stephen Ambrose speaking with Neil Conan on Fresh Air. Ambrose died yesterday. We'll hear more of this interview, which was recorded in 2001. After a break, this is Fresh Air. Best-selling historian Stephen Ambrose died yesterday at the age of 66. We're listening back to an interview he recorded in August of 2001 when Neil Conan was guest hosting Fresh Air. Ambrose had just published The Wild Blue, the story of B-24s and the men and boys who flew these heavy bombers in World War II. It focused on the experiences of one crew and its pilot, George McGovern, who was later elected to the Senate and ran for president.
McGovern's crew got its first taste of real combat on their second mission, and it's something you describe in your book. And I was wondering if you could read us an excerpt. It's about their second mission together as a crew, and they're flying to a target in Austria called Linz.
Hitler's birthplace.
Hmm.
It was at Linz, on this, their second mission, that McGovern said, "We got introduced to combat. The flak was heavy." Up to that point, McGovern had thought that exploding flak looked like firecrackers and rockets going off. He learned better when a big slug of flak came right through the windshield, high into my right. It hit just above my right shoulder and to the right of my head and then fell down onto the floor between Rounds and me. Rounds was his co-pilot. McGovern and Rounds looked down at it. Rounds looked over to McGovern and just shook his head. McGovern did the same. The shrapnel was, McGovern later said, the angriest-looking piece of metal, just jagged on every edge and big enough to tear your head off if it hit a few inches to the left or maybe a few more inches on Bill Round's side. It was freezing at 25,000 feet, 50 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, in the cold rush of wind. Despite all the sheepskin-lined jackets and pants they had on, despite their electrically heated suits, it was just ferocious, that cold rush of wind. McGovern managed to keep his plane in formation, but barely. All I could do was just sit there and do my job, he said.
There must have been an awful feeling of lack of control when you're up there being fired at by cannon 88s, those famous German guns from the ground. There's no way to dodge. There's nowhere to hide.
The Germans developed a system in which they would shoot up to the altitude the planes were coming in on, 20,000, 22,000, whatever, and they would shoot up and create a box of exploding shells, all of them sending out shrapnel that could kill it as much as 50 feet or even more away. And they would have a box that would be 2,000 feet or more wide, 2,000 or more feet deep, and it just looked like, and this is the words of the pilots, it just looked like hell up there. And the idea of flying into that terrified everybody. But if you were going to drop your bombs where you were supposed to, you had to fly into that flak. And they did.
Stephen Ambrose, a lot of people must wonder, you never served in the U.S. military yourself.
No, I did not. There's a explanation. I was born in January of 1936. Now, every man alive from the beginning of time always has a question in his mind. Am I a coward? And the only way you're ever going to find out is to go into combat. But most men are born at a time that they're never going to see combat. I was too young for World War II. I graduated high school in 1953, and I was going to join the Marines, but Eisenhower shut down the Korean War, so I went to college instead. And by the time of Vietnam, I had five kids, and I was much too old. That's the experience of most men. I don't know if I'm a coward or not. I've never been confronted with it. I've never was in combat. Right.
Why did you get so interested in writing about it? You've written, I'm not going to tote them up, but you know, a bunch of many of the best books about World War II.
I got into it because I was a historian trained at the University of Wisconsin, and it seemed to me then, and does now, that war is always decisive. The thing that drives me as a writer is curiosity. I wanted to know, how did Dwight Eisenhower rise from a man that, had he died in 1941 when he was 51 years old, nobody would have ever heard his name? How did he rise from that to be the Supreme Commander and our leader in war and in peace? Or how did the men who jumped out of airplanes, you talk about crazy, these guys jump out of perfectly good airplanes. How did they do that, and with what effect? So my curiosity drives me, and I never have considered doing anything else than satisfying that curiosity. And that means the only way I can really find, I did a book on the building of the Transcontinental Railroad, for example, and my question there was the same. How did they do that? How, from between 1863 and 1869, in that short space of time, did they do something that had never been done before, build a railroad across the continent? Well, I can only find the answer to that question by writing about it. The research is what I learned from, and then also the writing. And I'll think, geez, what does the reader need to know next to be able to follow this story? Or I'm doing a little repetition here, I got to cut that out, or whatever. But I learn from the act of writing. And that's what I've always wanted to do, is learn.
Historian Stephen Ambrose speaking with Neil Conan in August of 2001, when Neil was guest hosting Fresh Air. Ambrose died yesterday at the age of 66. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Lauren Krenzel. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of They All Laughed at Christopher Columbus, An Incurable Dreamer Builds the First Civilian Spaceship, by Elizabeth Weil, available in hardcover. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Wiley, publishers of Turning Points, a new book series featuring Jackie Robinson and the Integration of Baseball by Scott Simon, host of NPR's Weekend Edition, now at your local BookSense bookseller or wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Bass player Ron Carter has a new CD. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about his life and music, including his classic recordings with Miles Davis. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.